capable of distinguishing fake news, only at best to suspect it, based on origin. Only human fact-checkers can ascertain if a story is fake or not, and how high on the scale of credibility. A digital space needs rules. Facebook already has rules. It famously deleted the iconic image from the Vietnam War of a naked girl running away from her burning village. It also deleted a post by the Norwegian Prime Minister critical of Facebook's actions. A human editor would have recognized the image as the iconic war photo. The AI did not. There's a bigger, if unpublicized, reason Facebook as of yet refuses to bring back human editors. It would introduce cost. Why do something the users can do themselves? You get to hide behind freedom of speech even if you have a crowded theater and someone yells, "Fire!" Fear and outrage? All the better. Facebook has good reason not to see itself as a media company. It's too much work, and would introduce friction to growth. And that's something the four don't do. Utopia, dystopia. Media platforms where you are the product have empowered, connected, and facilitated greater empathy among billions of people. The shift in value from old media to new media firms will result in job destruction, and as with any upheaval, risks. The greatest threats to modern civilization have come from people and movements who had one thing in common: controlling and perverting the media to their own devices in the absence of a fourth estate that was protected from intimidation and expected to pursue the truth. A disturbing aspect of today's media duopoly, Facebook and Google, is their "don't call us media, we're a platform" stance. This abdication from social responsibility, enabling authoritarians and hostile actors to deftly use fake news, risks that the next big medium may, again, be cave walls. Chapter 5. Google. A religion that stressed the magnificence of the universe as revealed by modern science might be able to draw forth reserves of reverence and awe hardly tapped by conventional faiths. Sooner or later, such a religion will emerge. Carl Sagan. Mr. Sagan's religion is here. It's Google. Most people, for most of human history, have believed in a higher power. Terrifying weather events led humans to conjure a sentient being orchestrating these phenomena as a response to their behavior. Religion has brought, and still brings, psychological benefits if you're the right candidate. Church, mosque, and temple-goers score higher on optimism and cooperation with one another, which are key paths to prosperity. Believers are more likely to survive than their atheist friends. However, religion in mature economies is dying. Over the last 20 years in the United States, the number of people who claim no religious affiliation has increased by 25 million. The strongest signal for disbelief is internet usage, accounting for more than a quarter of America's drift from religion. Access to information and education has done a number on belief. People with graduate degrees are less likely to turn to religion than high school graduates. You are also less likely to believe in God if you have a high IQ. Only 1 in 6 people with an IQ above 140, uber smart, report deriving satisfaction from religion. When Nietzsche proclaimed "God is dead," it wasn't a victory cry, but a lamentation on the loss of moral compass. As we survive and prosper at greater rates worldwide, what is the glue that holds us together as a human family? What helps us live a better life? How do we learn more, discover more opportunities, find answers to the questions that fascinate and plague us? Good to know. Knowledge. We have been fascinated with it since antiquity. Know thyself, admonished the Oracle of Delphi. In the Age of Enlightenment, questioning myths became not only okay, but noble, the foundation of liberty, tolerance, progress. Science and philosophy flourished. Religious dogma was challenged with the simple slogan, "Dare to know." More than anything else, we want to know. We want to be sure our spouse still loves us, that our child is safe. Anybody with kids knows the universe collapses to your child, and nothing more when he or she is ailing. When the kid wakes up with a fever or breaks out in hives, we must know, will my universe, my kid, be okay? The logical part of the brain, the cerebrum, is able to, mostly, calm the reptilian fear brain with facts. Google answers every question. Our pagan ancestors lived mostly with mysteries. God heard your prayers, but didn't answer many of them. If God did speak to you, it meant you were hearing voices, a red flag in any psychological assessment. Most religious people feel watched over, but still don't always know what to do. Unlike our ancestors, we are able to find safety in facts. Our questions are answered immediately, our rest assured. How to detect carbon monoxide? Here are 5 ways. Google even highlights the top answer. Here's what you need to know in big type in case you're freaking out right now. Our first instinct is survival. God was meant to provide safety, but only to those who were righteous and denied all their desires. History is replete with believers who begged, fasted, and beat themselves with sticks to implore God for protection and answers. "Is another tribe preparing to attack us?" the oracle at Perperikon would be asked as she poured wine over hot stone. "Who's our greatest enemy?" It was harder to determine North Korea's nuclear headcount back then. Now, we just type it into the search field. Prayer. Science has looked for God, or a higher intelligence. Over the last century, there have been numerous well-funded efforts to scan the universe for radio emissions that might register life. For example, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, SETI. Carl Sagan cogently compared this effort to a prayer, lifting your gaze to the heavens, sending up data, and waiting for a response from a more intelligent being. We hope that this super being can capture, process, and return an answer. In the midst of the AIDS crisis, psychiatrist Elizabeth Targ of the University of California, San Francisco, invited psychic healers from as far as 1,500 miles away to pray for 10 subjects, each with advanced AIDS. The control group, also 10 people, received no prayers from the healers. The results were astonishing and published in the Western Journal of Medicine. During the 6-month study, 4 subjects died, all from the control group. Dr. Targ did a follow-up study that also showed a statistically significant difference in the levels of CD4+ between test and control groups. Tragically, Dr. Targ died soon after publishing her research. She was just 40 and had been diagnosed with glioblastoma only 4 months before. She died in furtherance of her research, surrounded by chaos. A cacophony of instructions from shamans, Lakota sun dancers, and Russian psychics. After her death, her research didn't hold up to additional scrutiny. Further examination revealed the 4 patients who died in the original study were the oldest of the 20 subjects. The effectiveness of prayer, the additional scrutiny determined, remains a matter of opinion. Prayers to Google, however, are answered. It offers knowledge to everyone, despite background or educational level. If you have a smartphone, 88% of consumers, or an internet connection, 40%, you can have any question answered. If you want to witness a small part of the staggering diversity of questions asked of Google in real time, go to google.com/about and scroll down to What the World is Searching for Now. 3.5 billion times each day, human beings turn their gaze not upward, but downward to their screen. We won't be judged for asking the wrong question. Sheer ignorance is welcome. What is Brexit? When is fever dangerous? Or plain curiosity. Best tacos in Austin. And we pour out the deepest questions of our heart to our modern-day God. Why is he not calling me back? How do you know if you should get a divorce? And answers mysteriously appear. Google's algorithms, a work of divine intervention in the eyes of most of us, summon compilations of useful information. The Mountain View search firm answers the questions that plague us, trivial and profound, easing our suffering. Its search results are our benediction. Go, take your newfound knowledge, and live a better life. Trust. Apple is considered the most innovative company in the world. Amazon the most reputable, whatever that means. Facebook is thought of as the best firm to work for. But the trust we place in Google is unrivaled. One sense in which Google is our modern God is that it knows our deepest secrets. It's clairvoyant, keeping a tally of our thoughts and intentions. With our queries, we confess things to Google that we wouldn't share with our priest, rabbi, mother, best friend, or doctor. Whether it's stalking an old girlfriend, figuring out what caused your rash, or looking up if you have an unhealthy fetish or are just really into feet, we confide in Google at a level and frequency that would scare off any friend, no matter how understanding. We place immense trust in the mechanism. About 1 in 6 Google queries are questions that have never been asked before. What other institution, professional or clergy, has so much credibility and trust that people bring their previously unanswerable questions to them? What guru is so wise that he inspired so many original questions? Google bolsters its godlike pose by denoting clearly which search results are organic and which are paid. This boosts confidence in its search, since it seems to be untethered from the marketplace. The result is that Google's scriptures, its search returns, represent for many a stream of unrivaled veracity. Yet Google gets to have it both ways. Organic search preserves neutrality, while paid content allows ad revenue. And no one complains. God is seen as having no agenda when answering queries. He is omnipotent and impartial, loving all his children equally. Google's organic search gives out information that is fair and impartial, with no judgment on who or where you are. Organic search results are based only on relevance to your search terms. Search engine optimization can help your site get picked up and appear higher in the list, but SEO is still free and based on relevance. Consumers trust organic results. We love this impartiality and click on organic results more often than ads. The difference is Google makes money exacting a toll from anybody, Nespresso, Long Beach Nissan, or Keds, that wants to eavesdrop on our hopes, dreams, and worries and present us with ideas on how to address them. Just as there were personal computers before Apple, online booksellers before Amazon, and social networks before Facebook, there were also search engines before Google. Just Ask Jeeves or Overture. Similarly, just as one or two seemingly minor product features separated the other four from their packs and turned them into world conquerors, Jobs' design and Wozniak's architecture for the Apple II, the rating and review system for Amazon, photos at Facebook. At Google, the defining factors were the elegantly simple homepage and the fact that advertisers weren't allowed to influence search results. Organic search. Neither feature may seem important 2 decades later, but at the time they were a revelation. They've gone a long way to creating trust. Google's colorful, uncluttered homepage said to even the most neophyte web surfer, "Go for it. Type in anything you want to know. There's no trick involved and no expertise required. We'll take care of everything." Meanwhile, when users realized they were getting the best answer, not the one most paid for, it was as if, to continue the biblical analogy, they were seeing the way, the truth, and the light. A bond of trust was created that has survived now for a generation and has made Google the most influential of the four. This trust didn't just extend to Google's users, but just as important to its corporate clients. With Google's auction formula, if advertisers wanted traffic, customers set the prices for each click. If demand drops, so do prices. And you pay just above what someone else was willing to pay, building trust that Google is benign. The result is that corporate customers believe Google's business is run by mathematics, not greed. Once again, the truth. Fair, impartial, constantly calibrated to be equitable. Compare this trust to the rest of media. Most media outlets, literally and intentionally, do not tell you where the bullshit starts or stops and pretend to have a Chinese wall between editorial and advertising. Some are cleaner than others, but money talks. If you want regular coverage in Vogue, then you need to advertise. It's no accident Marissa Meyer got a feature in the magazine, photographed by a top fashion photographer, the same year Yahoo sponsored Vogue's Met Ball. Yahoo shareholders paid $3 million so Ms. Meyer could appear in Vogue. Google, in contrast, keeps that homepage inviolate. It's reserved for search alone, plus the public service animation of the logo, the Google Doodles. No amount of advertiser money can buy space on the Google homepage. Google anticipated the need for a trust economy in the internet age and helped create it. In Q3 2016 results, Google had a 42% increase in paid clicks. However, the revenue captured, cost per click, declined 11%. Analysts mistook this as a negative. Declining prices are typically a reflection of loss of power in the marketplace, as no firm ever willingly drops prices. However, what we missed is that Google was able to grow revenues 23% that year, and, here's the key part, lower cost to advertisers by 11%. Whether you're the New York Times or Clear Channel Outdoor, a competitor lowered its prices 11%. And word is, it's great at what it does and isn't desperate at all. What if BMW was able to improve their cars dramatically each year while lowering prices 11% annually? The rest of the auto industry would have trouble keeping up. And yes, the rest of the media industry, sans Facebook, is having trouble keeping up with Google. Google found $90 billion in the collection plate in 2016 and commanded $36 billion in cash flow. Several times, Congress has debated an incremental tax on firms in sectors that appear to vastly outperform the S&P. Yet nobody has ever suggested extra taxes on Google. In many religious faiths, to not avert one's eyes from God's face is certain death. The same fate would probably befall the career of any congressman attempting to interfere with Google's progress. Similar to the other horsemen, Google tends to drive prices down, not up. Most consumer firms push in the other direction. They spend a lot of time trying to calculate the maximum price they can charge and capture all excess consumer value. Booking a same-day flight? Why, you must be a business traveler. Please, bend over. Google works differently, which is why it has grown dramatically year after year after year. And like the other horsemen, it sucks the profits out of its sector. The irony is that Google's victims invited the company in, letting Google crawl their data. Now, Google's extraordinary market cap is equal to the next 8 biggest media companies combined. Few people can explain how Google works, or what Alphabet exactly is. Alphabet incorporated in 2015, and Google is one of its subsidiaries in addition to Google Ventures, Google X, and Google Capital. People have an idea about Apple. It builds beautiful objects around computer chips. People understand Amazon. You buy a bunch of stuff at a low price, then people, robots, in a big warehouse, pick, pack, and get it to you, fast. Facebook? A network of friends linked to ads. But few people understand what happens inside a holding company that happens to hold a gigantic search engine. Minority Report. The 2002 Tom Cruise film Minority Report imagines a world where 3 mutated humans, precogs, can see the future and predict criminal acts. The police can then intercede before the crime actually occurs. One of these precogs is better at it than the others, and occasionally sees an alternate future that's hidden. Her better visions are filed away in a minority report. Google is a better precog. These are some of the Google queries people have typed in before committing murder, discovered by authorities, unfortunately, post-crime. Next snap break. When someone pisses you off, is it worth it to kill them? Average sentences for manslaughter and murder. Fatal digoxin doses. Could you kill someone in their sleep and no one would think it was murder? The Apple privacy dust-up of 2016 will seem trivial as Google's precog powers grow. This will come when a thin layer of AI on top of search queries and a few other data streams, including our movements, are used effectively to predict crime, disease, and stock prices. The information on a smartphone can already put a criminal in prison. But the string of search queries that come barreling out of our lizard brains, that's where the really crazy shit can be found. The temptation to create predictive links between intention and action will be irresistible to governments, hackers, and rogue employees. Look at your recent Google search history. You reveal things to Google that you wouldn't want anyone to know. We believe naively that nobody but the big guy can listen to our thoughts. But let's be clear, Google too is listening. To date, Google has been masterful at keeping this fear in check and not exploiting, as far as we know, the predictive power of its algorithms. Even the company's initial motto, "Don't be evil," attempts to reinforce the divine benevolence of this near-supreme being. Moreover, you can be banished. Google has cast out payday lenders, white supremacists, or any firm that charges an interest rate greater than 36%. They have been, to recoin a phrase, cast into outer darkness the unknown. But perhaps the greatest sin is to attempt to fool God. That is, game Google's search algorithm. There are 3.5 billion search queries a day. So in essence, the search algorithm gets 1/3 billionth better every time you search. But that's not always the case. In 2011, a New York Times investigation revealed that a consultant working for JCPenney had created thousands upon thousands of false links to make it seem as though the JCPenney site was more relevant, that is, had a greater number of other sites linking to it. That false evidence led Google's algorithm to rank the site near the top of its search results, which juiced sales. When the Times uncovered this optimization, JCPenney promptly felt the wrath of God. The company was banished to oblivion. Second page on Google's search results, the equivalent of being left on the far bank of the Jordan River. One of God's awesome powers is the knowledge not only of what we do, but also what we want to do. We may not have confided in anyone, but as far as many believers are concerned, God knows that as we walk through the mall, We lust for a pair of Tory Burch Jolie pumps or Bose Quiet Comfort headphones. He knows you have a thing for girls with tattoos. Those are temptations God witnesses and registers. We signal our secret intentions with our queries and provide the Google search engine supernatural power in advertising. Traditional marketing sorted us into tribes: Latinos, Hicks, retirees, sports fans, soccer moms, and so on. Within those tribes, we are thought to be the same. In 2002, every single rich white suburbanite wore cargo pants, listened to Moby, and drove an Audi. But with Google, our queries, along with the photos, emails, and all the other data we provide, identify us as individuals with distinct problems, goals, and desires. This intelligence gives God a leg up in the advertising business. It can serve up ads that are more relevant, more benevolent, tailored to our personal happiness. Much of marketing is the art, disguised as science, of how to best change behavior. It wants to make us buy this versus that, think of this as cool versus that as lame. Google leaves the hard, expensive stuff to others, and just gives the people what they want after they've raised their digital hand and said, "I want something like this." Even better, Google pairs people with companies via AdWords before they may even know what they want, fly Delta, when signaling their intent via search queries about tours of the Acropolis or the slightest curiosity about Greek islands. The Old God. If Google is the god of information in the internet age, the closest thing we had in the old economy, with maybe the exception of the evening news, is the New York Times. Its longtime motto, "Everything that's fit to print," says what the paper aspires to. Every day it renders judgment on what's important, on what we should know. Of course the Times has its prejudices, every human institution does. But Times journalists pride themselves on keeping these judgments somewhat in check. They see themselves upholding progressive Western values and steer us away from the news that's not fit to print, whether porno or propaganda or advertising disguising itself as news. The editors at the Times curate our view of the world we inhabit. When Times editors choose the stories for their front page, they set the agenda for TV and radio news, for the whole mainstream view of the world. The stories circulate across the old world. 40% of the leaders of nations receive some version of the New York Times each morning. And the new, Facebook and Twitter. Journalism is hard, sometimes dangerous work that pursues truth versus just the commercial. The New York Times does it better than any media firm in the world. However, increasingly, the paper is not good at extracting value from the skills and risk-taking demonstrated in the newsroom. In fact, Google and Facebook do a better job extracting value from Times journalists than the management of the Times. I believe if the Times had refused to let any of its content on the Facebook or Google platforms, those younger companies would be worth at least 1% less. New York Times articles give these platforms tremendous credibility, and the Times, in return, gets very little. NY Low T. In 2008, the gap between the growing Google and the flagging New York Times was smaller than today. Google was already well into its stride, with a market cap that topped $200 billion. But the Times was enormously relevant. With the first iPhones arriving and tablets 3 years into the future, platforms and devices needed content, and the Times had the best. Without New York Times content, Google would have been at a disadvantage to anybody who had it, not least the Times itself. I felt the Times content could, and should, be worth billions in the digital age. Working with two NYU Stern students with finance backgrounds, we evaluated every aspect of the Times Company. Our conclusion? The Times Company was a $5 billion firm trapped in a $3 billion body. I approached Phil Falcone, founder of Harbinger Capital Partners. I partnered with Phil before. When I say partner, I mean his fund provided the capital for us to take a large ownership stake, obtain board seats, and advocate for change. Phil was one of 12 children raised in Minnesota. He had been a hockey star at Harvard before becoming a hedge fund manager. A focused introvert, Phil was one of a half a dozen investors with balls of steel who made a huge bet against the credit markets in 2006. This made billions for Phil and his investors. Harbinger's office had bad cherrywood trim, artificial plants, and old floor fans to keep the trading floor cool. It felt like a Regis office suite in Cleveland, minus the charm. I presented the idea to Phil. It involved both a surrender and a fight. I proposed that the Times Company could sell 10% of the company to former Google CEO Eric Schmidt and make him CEO of the paper. This was the surrender. I figured Schmidt could afford to buy 10% plus of the firm to give him a vested interest or upside. Eric had kicked himself upstairs to chairman of Google, making way for Larry Page to be CEO. I believed he was likely more open to a different idea, saving American journalism, than he may have been in the past. The stake would give him a chance to make money, though nothing on the scale of one of the four. I'm still convinced that if the Times had named Schmidt its CEO, the company's value would be dramatically larger. The next step, I continued, was for the company to fight. The Times should immediately turn off Google, and henceforth, the company should refuse to allow Google or any other company to crawl its content. Then, if Google or another internet player wanted to license the content of the New York Times, it would have to pay for it, and pay more than anybody else. Google, Bing, Amazon, Twitter, or Facebook could provide their users with unfettered access to our content. But only one of them, the highest bidder. Then, my plan was to stretch this strategy beyond the Times. I envisioned creating a consortium of newspaper owners. The Sulzbergers of the Times, the Grahams of the Washington Post, the Newhouses, Chandler's, Pearson, and Germany's Axel Springer, among others. This group would represent the highest quality, most differentiated media content in the Western world. This was our one and only chance to staunch the decline of print journalism and capture back billions in shareholder value. It wouldn't have lasted forever, but for an also-ran search engine like Microsoft's Bing, it could have provided a potent weapon against Google. Bing, at that point, had about 13% share of search. Exclusive rights to differentiated content via iconic brands, whether from The Times, The Economist, or Der Spiegel, had to be worth a few points of market share. This means of differentiation was worth billions. Today, the search industry is worth $500 billion. Some would argue more, as Amazon is technically a search engine with a warehouse attached. That means each point of market share in this industry is worth $5 billion plus. My plan was to form the consortium, lease our content, and start pushing back on tech firms that had built billions in stakeholder value based on our content. Even as the housing bubble showed signs of strain, and advertising continued to drift online, the newspaper business was robust, and properties were in play. Rupert Murdoch had just bought the Wall Street Journal for $5 billion, and the Times was trading at a much lower multiple. In addition, there were other buyers sniffing around. I had heard from two different sources that Michael Bloomberg was also contemplating a bid for the Times. Term limits, it seemed, were about to force him from office. And the Times was the perfect project for a New York billionaire who had taken financial information, brought it into the digital age, and created tens of billions of shareholder value in the process. We didn't know at the time that when you are Michael Bloomberg, term limit is more of a suggestion than a real limit. Bloomberg went on to strong-arm the city council into a third term. Finally, if all else failed, the New York Times Company owned a bunch of stuff we should and would sell, including the 7th tallest building in America, About.com, 17% of the Boston Red Sox, WTF. These assets were treated by the financial markets as newspaper assets, meaning their valuation was a multiple of profits assigned to a newspaper company, low. So the disposition of these assets would be accretive to shareholders. A sum of the parts analysis reflected that in buying a share of Times Company stock, you were getting the paper for almost nothing, based on the value of other assets. We would also lobby to kill the dividend, a payout for shareholders of around $25 million a year. The company needed the cash to reinvest in innovation. Best as I could tell, the dividend was merely protection money, so Arthur Sulzberger and Dan Golden wouldn't be killed at family get-togethers because they were being paid $3 to $5 million per year to fuck up Granddad's company and have lunch with Boutros Boutros-Ghali. The other cousins wanted their sugar, too. Phil's firm, Harbinger Capital, and Firebrand Partners, the name I gave my firm, teamed up to purchase $600 million in Times Company stock, about 18% of the company. This made us the largest shareholder. We announced we wanted 4 board seats and would push for shareholders to vote a slate of like-minded reformers to the board. We wanted the company to sell non-core assets and double down on digital. Harbinger was the brawn, capital. Firebrand was the brains. Lead the proxy fight, join the board, influence capital allocation decisions and strategy, unlock value, etc. Within the company, our plan met with resistance, of course. During our initial meeting with management, and after we laid out our thoughts, Arthur Sulzberger indignantly pronounced, "There isn't a single thing you've presented we haven't thought of." Despite this, we weren't convinced management didn't need help. Outside the walls of the Times building on 41st Street, a tower designed by Renzo Piano I was eager to unload, all hell broke loose. I had underestimated how fascinated the media was with itself. Within 24 hours of us announcing our strategy, there were paparazzi outside my class at NYU. The media also enjoyed beating up on the Times publisher and chairman Arthur Sulzberger. One Reuters reporter, who was working on a story about the dynamics of the Sulzberger family, called me on my cell one night at 11. He told me he would be fired the next day unless I gave him something, anything, for a story about our battle with the Times. He had assembled, with art supplies, an elaborate family tree, cousins, second cousins, with a level of detail that was downright creepy. It became clear that the world's media couldn't wrap its head around how it felt about the people who owned the media. Arthur Sulzberger and I took an immediate, almost visceral disliking to one another. We saw the world differently and approached it from entirely different angles. My whole life has been a quest to gain relevance and fear of never achieving it, whereas Arthur's biggest fear, I believe, was losing it. And to be clear, he was the CEO. He just gave Janet Robinson the title just so he wouldn't have to do the shit work of a CEO, firing people, earnings calls, etc. However, he made the big decisions and collected CEO-level compensation. The Sulzbergers, like many media families, employ a dual-class shareholder structure to keep them in control. The thinking is that media plays a special role in our society and should not be subject to the short-term thinking of shareholders. Most use this, Google, Facebook, Cablevision, as a ruse for the families to maintain control of the company while diversifying their stake, that is, selling shares. The Times is not one of these companies. The family is deeply committed to journalism. And it was clear, after getting to know Arthur, that the financial health of the Times was meaningful, but only in the pursuit of the profound. The Times's form of journalism. I imagine Arthur wakes up in a cold sweat frequently, fearing he could be the cousin that loses the New York Times. So the Sulzbergers, like many newspaper families, owned a minority of the equity, 18%, but controlled 10 of 15 seats on the board. That meant that agitators like me had to swing a whole bunch of family friends and members to the wild side. After sharing our ideas about digital and capital allocation, we continued to meet with shareholders to gauge support. Annual meetings are like elections, and shareholders, in this case, the Class A shareholders, get to vote for who will represent them on the board. Most shareholders we met with were fed up and felt the Times leadership had mismanaged the company. Everything indicated the company was ripe for change. The following week, the Times CEO, Janet Robinson, and director, Bill Kennard, asked to meet with Phil, without me, to see if we could come to a settlement. This meant they knew they were going to lose at the shareholder meeting. I felt Phil should demand all four seats we had nominated directors for. But Phil said we should demonstrate some good faith and settle for two. This was a mistake. We needed several voices to break through the cacophony of the board's thoughtful comments while not holding Arthur or Janet accountable for any real leadership. The Times Company agreed immediately with one condition. I wouldn't be one of the two. Reference earlier, visceral dislike. Phil recognized I had skin in the game and would not be co-opted by quarterly dinners with Nick Kristof and Thomas Friedman, along with $200,000 in board fees, stipend, and options. Instead, I would continue to push for change. So Phil demanded I get one of the seats, and they acquiesced. At the annual meeting in April 2008, Jim Kohlberg and I were elected to the board in an unexceptional shareholder meeting. After the meeting, Arthur asked to speak to me alone. He took me into a room and asked who the photographer was I had brought with me. I hadn't brought anybody with me. Not once, but two more times over the next hour, he pulled me into a room and demanded that, this time, I tell him who the photographer was. "Again, Arthur," I replied with increasing irritation. "I have no fucking idea. Don't ask me again." I don't know if Arthur sees dead people or was so stressed about having an uninvited guest shoved into his boardroom that he was hallucinating. There was no photographer. And so our relationship began with a petty sideshow reflecting our mutual distrust and disdain. He viewed me as an unwashed mongrel, in over his head, who had no license to be on the board of the Gray Lady. I viewed him as a silly rich kid with poor business judgment. Over the next couple years, we would prove each other right. Arthur lived and breathed the Times. His DNA was gray and wrapped in a blue plastic bag. It was hard even to imagine Arthur outside the building. I saw him once at a conference in Germany, and it was like seeing a giraffe on the 6th subway line. It just didn't fit. As you might guess, I didn't have any luck convincing the board to dump the CEO, Janet Robinson, and replace her with Eric Schmidt, a man with a deep understanding of the intersection between technology and media. I was basically laughed out of the room. No one wanted to take on the CEO and Arthur, and since I was a newcomer with no credibility, it was easy to quash the idea. This was several years before a tech CEO took over an ailing newspaper. In 2013, Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post. That had the salutary effect of eliminating the quarterly freakouts when the paper would unveil sinking numbers to investors, soon followed by the inevitable bloodletting in the newsroom. More than providing financial ballast, Bezos turned the Post toward the web with a vengeance. Its online traffic doubled in 3 years, leapfrogging the Times. And the Post developed a content management system that it's now leasing to other news outlets. According to the Columbia Journalism Review, this CMS could generate $100 million a year. WaPo is benefiting from the same blessing as Amazon. Cheap capital and the confidence to invest it aggressively and deftly for the long term, as if they were 18 again. My fellow directors at the Times Company had no stomach for this type of agita. It was a lot easier, they concluded long before I came, to confront the online challenge by acquiring an online player and extending its model to the web. About.com. In 2005, the New York Times Company purchased About.com, a growing set of sites, hundreds of them, that provided readers with specialty information about everything from pruning trees to prostate therapies. It was what was known as a content farm. The success formula for content farms was to engineer the sites with one overriding goal: leverage user-generated content that was optimized on Google, appear on the first page of Google search results, generating traffic, and thus sell advertising. It's not fair to say that the Times wasn't an innovator. It was, and it became a leading site with arresting graphics, data features, and video. But much of the online growth at the Times was as a collection of mediocre content engineered to capture clicks on Google through About.com. Similar to birds in Africa that sit on a rhino's ass all day long eating mites and ticks, the Times was riding on the back of a titan, one of the four. The folks at the Times didn't suspect it, but living on Google's search algorithm is a tenuous existence. It takes just one flick of the rhino's tail to knock the scavenging bird off. The Times paid $400 million for About.com, and, as the About sites harvested billions of clicks from Google searches, the purchase briefly looked deft. By the time I was aboard, the market value for About had risen to about $1 billion. About.com was hot property. I lobbied to sell, or spin it by taking it public. Naturally, people in the About group thought this was a fabulous idea. They were sick of propping up an analog company and hungry for internet equity and respect. At one point, I made a serious faux pas. At a meeting where About's senior management was present, I suggested selling the company or taking it public. This was irresponsible on my part. It was like screaming to a room full of 7-year-old boys, "Who wants to go to Monster Jam?" when you're not sure you can get tickets. However, Janet and Arthur didn't want to lose their online cred. They were busy using About as digital earrings to accessorize an analog outfit. It showed investors and the board, minus me, that the Times did have a digital strategy, one that was bringing in revenue and was poised to grow. They weren't closing their eyes to the future, they told themselves, but embracing it. Digital was bringing in only 12% of company revenue. Selling About would cause that number to shrink, and we might look like a newspaper company. Meanwhile, I was pushing at board meetings for the company to shut off Google's access to Times content. I could see that Google's search engine already was destroying shareholder value. If left unchecked, it would slowly and methodically asphyxiate us. Everybody else believed it was the electricity of the internet age and that the relationship was symbiotic. As an exchange for our content, we got traffic from Google. I remember one board meeting in particular. A Times reporter had been kidnapped in Afghanistan and was later rescued by British commandos. During the operation, one brave soldier was killed. The commander of the squadron wrote a moving letter to Arthur explaining why the heavy price was worth paying, why journalism matters. Arthur read the full letter to the board, pausing regularly to let us reflect before continuing. Journalism, sacrifice, deference, standing, geopolitics, ceremony. This was the giraffe on the plains of the Sudan woodlands, feeding on the intermittent vegetation of edaphic grassland and acacia. Arthur was in his element. Meanwhile, as we relished in the importance of, and sacrifices made for, journalism, Google crawlers entered our basement and scraped all our content from our servers as New York Times directors dined 17 floors above in the 7th tallest building in America. Google not only was crawling our content for free, it also was slicing and dicing that content for its users. When people were looking for a hotel in Paris, for example, Google would link to a New York Times travel article on Paris. But at the top of the page, it would place Google's own ad for the Four Seasons Hotel. The argument was that this arrangement brought traffic to the Times. It could sell these eyeballs to advertisers who would buy banner ads. It sounded good, but it was whistling through the graveyard. Here's the rub. As it was handling those searches, Google also was learning, better than the Times itself, exactly what the paper's readers wanted, and were likely to want in the future. And that meant Google could target those Times readers with far greater precision and make more money from each ad. As much as 10 times more. That meant we were exchanging dollars for dimes. We should be running our own ads on our sites. What idiots we were. Our sales team was average, and the business model was dying. The one thing we still had of value was our content, and the professionals who generate it. Yet instead of making that content scarce, shutting off and suing any digital platform that repurposed our content, we decided that we should try to drive more traffic by prostituting our content. Everywhere. This was the equivalent of Hermès deciding to distribute Birkin bags through Walmart.com, so Hermès.com could get more traffic. We committed one of the great missteps in modern business history. Overnight, we took a luxury brand, spread it through sewer-like distribution, and let the sewer owner charge less for it than we were charging in our own store, through subscriptions. I was resolute, armed with data, and I represented the largest shareholder. I fantasized that one day there would be case studies about how an angry professor helped the gray lady and journalism as a bonus. I made the case to the board that we needed to shut off Google's crawlers and create a global consortium of premium content. And in the hour that followed, there actually was semi-serious debate. It featured a group of mostly middle-aged, highly pedigreed gridiron greats who didn't know a fucking thing about technology. To her credit, Janet took the suggestion seriously and said management would evaluate my proposal. A few weeks later, the board received a thoughtful memo that said the New York Times should not shut off the search engine, as the paper couldn't risk angering Google because About.com depended on Google for traffic. If we turned off Google, Google might counter by tweaking its algorithm and relegating About to search engine purgatory. This, in a nutshell, is the problem with conglomerates and the innovator's dilemma. The whole is often less than the sum of its parts. That was true both of the Times and About. In a sense, we and Google were both using each other. Google used our content to attract billions of clicks for its ads, and we used their search algorithm to drive traffic to About. However, Google had far greater power. It ruled like a lord over a crucial swath of the internet. We were the equivalent of tenant farmers on that turf. Our fate was determined from the start. It took a while, but in February 2011, Google finally tired of the antics of content farms, including About.com, and it swatted them away. The search giant performed a Panda algorithm update, which exiled much of the content farm traffic and business into outer oblivion. With just one tweak, Google pummeled the Times, diverting millions in online revenue to other sites and cutting About's value dramatically. It appears that, unlike us, Google was making business decisions based on the long-term value of the company, unafraid of our reaction. About was worth $1 billion before the update, and less than half of that the next day. A year later, the Times unloaded the content farm for $300 million, 25% less than what it had paid for it. I'd venture that angering About.com's parent, the Times Company, wasn't a factor in Google's decision to do what was best for Google shareholders long term. God can give advice, influence, and, when needed, control. But as Greek mythology teaches us over and over, sleeping with gods never ends well. My tenure at the Times Company was not a success. Understatement. My suggestions changed little. the company did sell non-core assets and decided to cancel the dividend in 2009. However, in September 2013, it reinstated the dividend, signaling that the board was firmly controlled by the family. As the Great Recession pulverized the company's ad revenue and the stock dropped, Phil Falcone decided to limit his losses by selling stock. His ownership stake was the only thing keeping me on the board. And when that started to shrink, I got the word from a couple directors that I was gone. After Arthur left me a voicemail asking me to call him, I resigned. I had turned $600 million of other people's money into $350 million. As part of our board compensation, we were granted options. Mine were worth around $10,000 or $15,000. I just needed to fill out some paperwork. I decided not to. I didn't deserve it. Enter the new God. But God is much more, omniscient, omnipotent, and immortal. And of those three, Google is only the first, kinda. If Apple has managed to achieve a degree of immortality by converting itself into a luxury goods company, Google has accomplished the opposite. It has made itself into a public utility. It is ubiquitous, increasingly invisible in everyday use, and like Coke, Xerox, and Whiteout before, it increasingly needs to reinforce the legality of its brand name for fear it will become a verb. Its market dominance is so great that it's in perpetual risk of antitrust suits at home and abroad. The EU seems to have a particular animus toward the company, filing 4 formal charges since 2015. The European Commission has accused Google of unfair advantage over ad competitors. With a 90% share of EU search and headquarters not in the EU, Google is a right